This is Rob Long with Martini Shot for The Ankler. Everybody comes to Hollywood for different reasons, I guess. I mean, I came because I really didn't have any other skills, if you can call this a skill. In some cases, I could mention the reasons go deeper than stars in your eyes or the irresistible need to be a storyteller. I know one guy who became a TV writer simply because it afforded him the opportunity to write on a cop show and name all of the strippers, prostitutes, and nude female corpses after his mother. So, you know, you can unpack that if you like. Now, most of us think of Los Angeles as a place you come to rather than a place you come from, but some writers were here already. Here's a true story. The son of a famous television sitcom actor tried hopelessly to connect emotionally with his prickly and distant father once. The son had grown up to be a very successful television writer and producer himself, motivated probably by the icy limits of his father's affection, and he sat with his father near the end of his life for one last attempt at something, anything, resembling paternal warmth. "Isn't it amazing, Dad?" he is reported to have said in a softly plaintive voice, "that when I was a little boy and we lived on Maple Drive in Beverly Hills, you'd leave in the morning and head down Santa Monica Boulevard and take a right on Cahuenga and then pull into the studio and do your show. And now, when I'm grown, I live on Maple Drive too, and I have a little boy too, and I drive down Santa Monica and take the same right on Cahuenga and pull into the same studio where I have a show too. Isn't that amazing?" And his father looked into the middle distance and shrugged. "I took Willoughby," he said. You know, and that was that. Moral of the story, show people can light up the screen with wit and warmth, but at home they tend to the cruel and the cold. But the great thing about growing up in L.A., in the cradle of show business, where it really is the local business, is you can learn other useful things. In addition to learning what famous show business parents are withholding affection, you can learn how the mill works, how it churns out product. I know a writer who grew up in Hollywood. I don't mean that metaphorically. He grew up just north of Franklin, and he taught himself to write by slipping onto the Paramount lot, rummaging through the dumpsters and collecting old TV scripts, and he'd assemble them and reassemble them, arranging various drafts of an episode in chronological order, tracking the script as it changed from the table reading to final production, and then he'd try to figure out why certain lines or jokes or characters had changed or disappeared or reappeared. And some of the script revisions were baffling. The dialogue and plot twists that delighted him in the first draft would vanish by the third. "Why did they cut that?" he'd ask himself, poring over a script at the Astro Burger on Gower. "That was funny. That worked." Of course, some changes he saw coming. When a guest star had most of the good lines in an early draft, he'd sit slurping his Coke, shaking his head, and thinking, guys, give the jokes to the star. It's not the wacky mailman show. And he turned to the next draft and see that the mailman had suddenly been reduced to a single line. "Here's your mail, sir," followed by the direction "mailman exits." The clever riffs on the weather or junk mail or the letter carrier's blue shorts, they were all grafted onto speeches delivered by, the star of the show. Sitting at Astro Burger, reading draft after draft, this for him, this was film school. He learned a lot about the process, but the pitfall here is that when you see something change across many drafts of a script, you look for reasons, rational reasons, predictable reasons, why those changes occurred. But of course, not everything is what they call a teachable moment. A few years ago, I was volunteering for a few days on a pilot written by another friend of mine. The original script was excellent, but, you know, the stuff changes. Somewhere around the sixth day of production, as we were flying through an easy rewrite, one of the other volunteers pitched a small adjustment to the last scene. It was a breakfast scene, and all the characters were gathered around the kitchen table. "Wouldn't it be easier for the actress," the volunteer suggested, "if instead of, you know, waffles, they were all eating cereal and drinking coffee?" My friend shook his head. "I want them eating waffles," he said. "Yeah, but there's all that business with the waffle iron and the batter, and it's getting her pushed upstage. Cereal, just a box and some milk." "I want them eating waffles, okay?" the writer screamed. "Waffles. No pancakes or omelets or toast or cereal. That's what I want. That's my vision. Waffles." Although, to be totally accurate, he inserted a popular Anglo-Saxon gerund describing the sex act directly before the words "waffles, pancakes, omelets, toast, cereal, else, want, and vision, and waffles again." The room went deadly quiet. "Waffles," said my friend quietly and slowly. "Waffles is the last word in the script from the first draft. That's it. Waffles. In the past 6 days, every other word has changed. Every other word. The only thing from my original script is waffles. Although, to be totally accurate again, he inserted a popular Anglo-Saxon gerund describing the sex act directly before the words waffles, word, script, draft, it, days, other, changed, word, thing, script, and waffles again. It didn't matter that the volunteer was correct. Waffles and their accessories are complicated, messy, and inconvenient to film, and it didn't matter that the actress was going to be locked upstage for most of the scene at a waffle iron. It didn't even matter that between the pilot order, which came in January, and the pilot production week in late April, the network had launched two very successful reality shows, so the prospect of ordering a simple family comedy was about, you know, zero. What mattered was that waffles was the last remaining word of the original draft. So, by the time they called cut on that final scene, that actress really knew how to make waffles. And also, the soundstage smelled like an IHOP. Now, the one thing my friend missed all those years ago, sifting through the Paramount Studios rubbish bins, was that sometimes what stays in a script is a lot more interesting and educational than what gets cut. There was a time between the end of the typewriter era and the beginning of the internet era when the most powerful person on any movie or TV set was the person, usually a young person, often someone's assistant, who carried the script around on his or her computer, often the only copy, the master copy, of the multi-million dollar project. I knew a young person back then, well, I guess I was also a young person, too. Just never feels like that when you're telling a story, does it? Everyone who was young then stays young in your memory, except for you, just get older and grayer and slower and saggier, even in your own memory. Wait, where was I? Okay, right. Yeah. I knew a guy back then who carried around one of those old MacBook PowerBooks. Remember those? The PowerBook thing? And he was working for a director of a major picture. And whenever there was a discussion or a conference during pre-production, the director would wave at him and say, open it up. And he'd open up the document and type in some changes. Now, back then, the script writing software with what from today's vantage point seems like, you know, Tinker Toy capabilities, made it almost impossible to track the changes to the script as it went through successive versions. These days, each change is automatically marked by an asterisk, so anyone trying to follow the drafts only needs to zip through the script looking for asterisks. In fact, the note givers and executives and actors and everyone else giving input into a script, asking for this or that to be altered or punched up or changed or softened or sharpened or whatever, they all do exactly the same thing when they get the new draft. They flip through looking to see if their note was taken. They don't read the whole thing. They just want to know where they rate on the clout score. Now, smart writers and directors make sure everyone gets an asterisk in every draft. I mean, you know, why look for trouble? But sometimes it's a good political move just to make enough little changes to generate a constellation of asterisks on every page. Boy, they really are working hard on those revisions, is what you often hear, despite the fact that simply hitting this space bar and then backspace will generate a starred change, even though the line is utterly unaltered. Probably shouldn't have revealed that. Now, back when my friend was working for the director, there wasn't this level of sophisticated tracking. There was no order to any of it at all. The script and the changes were usually saved on the computer and then backed up to a floppy disk, which the same person would carry around. So, in effect, no matter who had the official writing credit, no matter who was truly in charge of the production, no matter how many note givers there were, the de facto most powerful person was my friend, the 23-year-old, who carried around the MacBook and who knew that in all likelihood no one was ever going to reread the whole script again. They wouldn't know how to keep scores. Some wouldn't even know that a line had been changed or not until the scene was being shot or the movie was already shot and finished. Although even then, you can make changes. The chief benefit of talking about a 30 or 40-year-old movie, I think, is that I really can't be expected to issue spoiler alerts. So even if you haven't seen Fatal Attraction, you almost surely know the basic plot points. A husband left alone for a weekend by his wife and children meets a woman, played by Glenn Close, who subsequently becomes obsessed with him. And, you know, it's a lot juicier than that, but we're just going to keep this upscale, okay? And as her obsession grows and becomes more violent and unwieldy, the husband, played by Michael Douglas, increasingly fears for his wife and family's safety. It all ends up with the wife, played by Ann Archer, shooting Glenn Close's character in the family bathroom. That's how it ended up. In any case, in the final version, the original ending included a violent suicide, a murder frame-up, and in one version, an unresolved mystery. But each version was screened in front of test audiences, and each time the audiences responded unfavorably to the endings. They were dissatisfied by the suicide. They didn't like the frame-up angle. They felt cheated by the final moments of the movie. The story goes that the director and the screenwriter argued long and hard about the ending. Despite the audience's reaction, they insisted that their original version was smarter and better and more artistically valid. Their original version, in other words, were waffles. But a new ending was shot. And this is the one that we geriatrics now saw in the theater. This is the one that the younger people saw later on Netflix or DVD. And when test audiences screened the new version, they cheered and applauded. The first rule of storytelling is there are no happy or sad endings. There are only endings that satisfy the audience and endings that do not. And if you want crowds to throng the theater, then you reshoot the ending as many times as necessary. You change the waffles to cereal. Now, I think you can actually see the original ending if you're interested, like everything else that's on YouTube, or so I've been told, which I guess is the modern version of the Paramount Studios dumpster where my friend, the local kid, learned the craft of writing for the screen. Now, the new version is a lot fairer and a lot more accessible for people. But I guess first you have to decide you're curious about what gets cut and what's left in and why. But if you are, the good news is that you don't need to grow up in a show business family, which, as we all know, sometimes brings other problems. And that's it for this week. Next week, we will buy a studio. For The Ankler, this is Rob Long with Martini Shot.